You know about animals.
Yes.
Do bees feel gratitude?
Gratitude?
Yeah.
I mean, no. I mean, maybe. But in my experience, they just sting you when they get pissed off.
Because if you see a bee in your house, you drop everything to rescue them. And all the time you try and reassure them. Like, it's okay, Mr. Bee, everything's going to be fine. Fly or wasp, out comes the poison gas. No sympathy for flies, of course, because every summer they're flying into a Diptera Jonestown in my kitchen. And instead of fleeing in terror, they're like, oh, seems like a fun place to hang out with all the corpses of my kind. But bees, I don't expect them to vocalise it. It'd be just nice to think that they're inwardly appreciative of this benevolent giant who's just saved their lives.
Saying that, I think wasps might be getting there because I saw an article today, genuinely, that was titled, Wasps Can Be As Good As Bees If They're Only Given A Chance, which was clearly written by a wasp.
Oh, hi, didn't see you there. This is Everyone's Eyes in Sunderland, a podcast about growing up terrified in the 80s and 90s. Every week we take a trip back to a year of our northeast childhoods and see what we can sort of remember happening, including some of the notorious crimes which happened close by while we were watching Singled Out with Jenny McCarthy. With me as always, Gareth Alexander, the former DVD reviewer of The Sun. That's the newspaper, not the celestial body.
Hello, and the voice that you just heard there was John Hart, who is probably best known for his interview with World Cup winning rugby coach Clive Woodward, which he ended by saying, great questions, by the way.
He did.
And John, that's an oddly niche topic, even for our podcast, and even more so that we'll get into a short while later for whatever other audience may be listening to this.
No, I put that Clive Woodward interview in because in 1995, rugby went professional union, and he was the first professional manager. Talked about it during the interview, how underprepared his employers were. So he turned up for his first day as the England manager and was like, so where's my office? And the RFU were like, it's never come up.
Dear. Was that one of the questions that you asked him? How was your office on that first day?
No, I asked him mainly about football, which is why he appreciated it.
And just for any other listeners, rugby is American football and football is soccer.
We'll get to that too. With us, as always, Claire Robinson, who this week used the group chat to volunteer a ridiculous irrational fear just a month after we had it as a topic.
Well, people are catching up with the episode, so yeah, they're now filtering all of these things through, and I'm like, oh, okay, I don't even know what episode it was from. But yeah, the irrational fear was from Liam, and his irrational fear is that when he's driving, he runs over an invisible person at a zebra crossing, and then they mysteriously then reappear, and he has to justify how he didn't actually murder them. They were invisible, and he genuinely didn't try and kill them. And this is a genuine fear that he has while he drives around in the streets of Durham City.
Sheesh.
Yeah, bit dark.
It was. I didn't realise it was a third party. I assumed when you volunteered it was you.
Oh, no, it's not me. If there's an invisible person and I ran them over, I probably wouldn't give much of a
You're
shit. I'd just
it.
Drive by.
You've had your chance.
Yeah.
But not only that, this week is a very, very special episode in Everyone Dies in Sunderland because we are joined by Madison and Lindsay from Yale Crime Podcast. Welcome to the show from across the Atlantic, guys.
Hi,
hello.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
We are so, so excited to have you. Yes, as a change of pace tonight, we are giving over our notorious Northeast crime to someone else to come in and do it. It's not technically the 80s and 90s.
I mean, it depends on what century you're going back towards.
True.
It's, I think the closest is the 1780s and 90s.
Which are years that, to be fair, are a little bit hard for us to remember because we weren't there. But
I can't name a single sitcom from the 1780s or 90s. Don't even think that the Goons were around then, so.
Yes, you're going to take us through a crime which happened in Northumberland, which I am looking at right now, but you is, and I don't know exactly where you live, but my best estimate is a crime which took place some 3,787 miles away from you.
Sounds about right, yeah.
Yeah, that's about it. Yeah, pretty close.
Checks out.
So actually, should we quickly, before we go anything else, in case any of our listeners aren't aware of your show, do you want to give us your quick elevator pitch, what you guys are all about?
Sure. As you said, we're Lindsay and Madison from the Ye Olde Crime Podcast. We discuss crimes that take place pre-1900s, and we kind of cover cases all over the place, a lot of them in England, just because you have a much longer history than we do in America, mm-hmm. As runaways.
And well, at least a history that we didn't stomp and burn on mm-hmm. and then recreate ourselves.
Yes.
That's after the fact.
Yes. Yes.
That's like, our that history too, to be fair.
Be like, that was great.
Very
that
true.
Sounded awesome. Let's do that here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're just going to bring that over. Yeah, we just so happened to cover a case that you mentioned literally happens basically in your backyard. So we're excited to kind of share that with your listeners.
What was the inspiration for your podcast? Because I know that this one was literally John, who I've known since university, coming up to me one day and saying, I've got a great title for a podcast. And me going, what was that? Everyone Dies in Sunderland. And what's that about then? We'll work that out on the way. So well, I'm just curious as to what your guys' background is in this.
Basically, I've always been a really big fan of history, specifically the horrible things that happened in history, because that's the type of person that I am. And which is hilarious considering I was really bad at history in school. I'm not so good with numbers, but I'm really good at remembering bad things that happen. So, which is always sort of a fun thing to research and talk about with other people because, you know, who doesn't love hearing about horrific murders that happened in the 1700s? And I just kind of basically tricked my sister into joining me on this venture because I didn't know who else would sit with me and allow me to talk to them about horrible crimes for...
Very similar to our dynamic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think that's it. I think if people, and that's why there's a TV series and a book series, just diverting briefly, in the UK called Horrible Histories, which goes into all of that really, really gruesome stuff. I think if when you were at school were taught about, even if it was incredibly specific, horrible things that happened in time, you'd be much more inclined to pay interest to history than just generally glossing over. And this is the First World War and what happened. And this is the Second World War and what happened. Mm-hmm. And this is the Tudors. And do you know all of the kings? And I guess for you, and these were the Pilgrim Fathers. And this was the Declaration of Independence. And I've got a very narrow view of American culture, by the way.
No, you are giving...
Mostly informed by sitcoms, unsurprisingly.
You're giving the American education system way too much credit right now.
Okay. No. It's more like, where did all these different random battles take place during the Civil War? And can you remember what dates and places they took place in, even though you really will never need this information ever again in your life?
Yep. Which side was racist? You find out. Hint, it's South.
In fact, I was trying to research George IV today in preparation for Madison and Lindsay's true crime. Because all I remember about George IV, who was the king during this period and briefly appears in the story, was the bit from Horrible Histories where he sings the song that all you remember is I was fat.
Yeah. I ate lots of pies, John, is the lyric.
Yeah.
I used to know that song off by heart. He also didn't design Buckingham Palace or a few of the palaces, definitely. Yeah. Duchesses and actresses, do you remember that? That's it, yeah. No, the only thing you remember was I was really fat. Yeah, that's it. It's a great song.
So George IV, and known henceforth as Angry, Fat and Cross, you beat Napoleon, but otherwise you're a dead loss, as Queen Victoria sings to him in another song from Horrible Histories. But let's not draw people's attention to much more successful and better comedy vehicles. So yes, as I hinted at previously, this is the first transatlantic Zoom call I've done since the early days of lockdown number one, when my friend Ben decided we should get the gang from college together for the first time in about 20 years. And in case you're wondering how that turned out, we're mostly fat and balding now, but none of us are interesting. Apart from my ex, who hasn't aged a single day and lives in California now, and her house looks lovely. So thanks a bunch, Ben. You raised my morale sky high.
If it makes you feel better, she might have been born with it, but it also may have been meth. That's very popular in California. Could be kale.
It's probably more likely to be kale, to be fair. What I've also realized a lot this week is we might have to translate a lot, which I hadn't anticipated. So when Claire said zebra crossing earlier, she meant marked crosswalk. And when I said college before, I meant junior / senior year in high school, not university college.
Yes.
And the most sad part of this is it does mean I have had to drop a really good joke about MOTs and dogging. I wrote this.
After... Yeah, I don't think dogging translates.
It doesn't, no. I workshopped it with friend of the show, Samir, who is a British-born American citizen, about how Americans would understand it. And we played it around for a long time with vehicle registration inspection and cruising, but it wasn't the same, so it's been pulled. We'll have to wait. Samir wants a catchy nickname, by the way, but this is the first time today I've looked at where our listeners are in the world. And there are 4 downloads from his hometown. And we've got 8 shows out there now. So catchy nicknames are for completest sunshine. Hello to our listener in Tunisia, by the way, whoever you are.
Who do we know in Tunisia?
what also came up when we were setting this show up was me feeling the most English I've ever felt. Because I really did say during the conversation, no, I can't do that. My son has cricket practice.
I did giggle a little bit about that.
Yeah. So I wanted to open that up to the floor and say, for the English among us, when's the most English you've ever felt? And to the Americans, when is the most American?
I can go first if you would like to hear a really embarrassing story from when I was actually over in the UK and Ireland when I was 16.
Love it.
Oh, yes, always. Please.
So I was part of a really fun and very effective program called People to People, where they would take 16-year-old children from the United States and send them overseas as part of like some sort of goodwill mission, I guess, for showing just how great teenage children from the Midwest are.
And it was a pyramid scheme, but
I'm sure it was. we did try to sell something to everybody that we visited. But I was able to stay with a host family in London, I believe, and then another in Ireland. And when I was in London with a very lovely couple who had a Dalmatian, and I didn't realize that the Dalmatians can actually break off the tips of their tails if they wag them too hard. So that was a terrifying thing that I learned.
I wrote an essay about that at university, but it was news to me and Gareth.
Yeah, apparently it just like bleeds everywhere. But enough about that. And so the day before, we had gone to this really big hill. I'm going to say it's a hill because it wasn't really a mountain. And we all decided that it was going to be really fun to roll down it, you know, like logs down a hill.
Because it would have been fun.
Mm-hmm. It was fun until you hit your head on a rock. And then it wasn't as fun the rest of the way back. Needless to say, I had gotten a lot of grass stains on my khakis. So when I got back to my host family, I had asked if she could wash my pants for me, not remembering that pants is in English underwear and it's trousers in English. So she gave me a very funny look when I said I had grass stains on my pants until I like showed them to her. And she was like, oh, you mean trousers? And I was like, yes, I am not a sexual deviant.
That's a great story. What I will say is we don't need to know how good teenagers are from the American Midwest because we do get Superman comics here and, you know, Superboy, pretty decent dude. So you didn't even need to come really and embarrass yourself like that.
We used to, when my sister moved out, she's quite a lot older than me, we had a spare room. So we used to rent out her room and we had American students who would come over every year and spend time in there. So it'd be crazy if it was the same program and somehow we were connected by that. A different allocation of young Americans. And you might have been living in my house in 1995.
I live in Scotland now, so I feel the most English I feel every single day of my life. So every day is when I feel the most English, unless John... you want me to tell that partridge story again.
Oh, that's a good story, though.
In Glasgow, I went to a nice fine dining pub and I looked at the menu and tutted and made a disgusted face that only the British can do. And one of my friends turned to me and said, what's the matter, Gareth? And I said, well, I've already had pheasant this week. And yeah. That's when I found it. And it might have been partridge. It might change every time I tell it. I can't quite remember. It was definitely one of the pea game birds.
Partridge last time.
Last time you told the story on this podcast, it was partridge. Can confirm.
It was probably partridge. But I eat so many delicious middle-class game birds that I sometimes lose track.
You can just say you're trying to relate to us because people kill pheasants in the Midwest.
No, they do here as well. Yeah, cool. We'll use that.
Usually with
Scottish American crossover.
Yeah, mostly with cars for us.
Do you have the same laws that we do that I never take advantage of, which is you can't run it over and then pick it up yourself to eat, but if the person in front of you runs it over, then you can get out of your car, pick it up and take it home to eat. That's a fun roadkill fact in the UK.
Well, funnily enough, our rules change state to state. Where I'm currently residing now, you can't. Like, if anybody hits it, it's for the crows and vultures and hawks and whatever hungry bears that are around.
Maybe it's just our history and our caricature of having awful, awful food in England that we've just come up with this, invented this law that means that we can just scrape it up off the road because it's probably better than what we're going to be eating anyway, because that's just mud, isn't it? Let's face it. You just eat mud in this country.
I take advantage of that law, though. Like, I've genuinely picked up roadkill and taken over and eaten it before.
That's great. Mm. I would do that.
I have seen people, if they hit a deer, because deer hunting is such a big thing here, especially in the Midwest, I have seen somebody stop and then just try to take the top half of the deer because it had enough horns or, like, things on its antlers where it was like, oh, I don't need to go shoot one because there's one sitting right here. I'll just take this and pretend that I shot it and then just leave the rest of it.
Just mount it on my wall.
Yeah.
Yeah. Classy.
I mean, that's more depressing than taking it home and eating it, I think, because it's an achievement of nothing. It's got no significance whatsoever. And you're not even having delicious, delicious deer.
Yeah. I think the most terrifying aspect of actually seeing that in person was knowing that someone just kept a chainsaw in the trunk of their car just for such occasions.
That was the only reason they had that chainsaw there. Absolutely.
Totally checks out.
I live fairly rurally, not as rurally as Claire grew up in, but my wife Constance, Premier Ellie Kemper impersonator, also grew up very rurally. And we had someone who found similar situation, a deer who had been hit by a car on the road outside their house. And they rang up her to like, you're from Norfolk. You must know what to do with a critically injured venison that might be good eating.
Did she?
I think she had a broad understanding of like, you're going to want to shoot it in the head put it out of its misery, and then you've got to hang it up to drain the blood.
She knows. She knows her shit. She's got this down.
Yeah, she knows how to drain blood from a corpse.
Claire, do you have any English things, or indeed, Madison, do you have any American things? Or did you just prepare somebody else's answer from 3 weeks ago and thought, job done?
Yeah, I'll totally like plagiarise it. But no, for this one, the most English I have ever felt, which sort of follows on from your tale about the partridge / pheasant or whatever game bird you ate that day. Because of my background, I take part in working dog trials. And quite a few years ago, I was on a shooting estate and we were shooting partridge that day and we were walking the line up and we were about to head back and it'd been a really long day. And the reason I felt the most British ever is because it's the first time I was on a shooting estate and someone offered me port, cheese and Christmas cake all in one go to have, and I felt very middle class, very British, and very like, oh my god, this is amazing right now. And then we raced back because we're all pissed off the port that we'd had.
Hit a few pheasants with your car on the way home.
Making up that roadkill for me tea.
I like the sound of working dog trials, because to me it sounds like a court case or something, and you've got little dog barristers, a dog jury, a dog judge. That's beautiful in my head.
Little wigs on.
My dog would rock a wig, let's face it.
Oh, you look amazing. Can we get him one?
Please do.
I don't really have much of one. I do have a friend who dated an Irish musician for a few years. And I just remember judging him very harshly for eating Taco Bell for the first time when he had come to America like every year for months. That was the most American and just like general, like uppity, like, why haven't you tried this cheap, delicious freedom food that isn't Mexican? Yeah, like, how dare you not know what a Baja Blast is? You scoomy fooker.
I can top that because I've been in a similar situation when I think I've been judged by The Office, not the physical place where me and Gareth work together, or at least did before the boring apocalypse, the TV show, because my parents do live at least part of the year, at least before the boring apocalypse, and they got trapped in this country in Central Florida. In a previous life, I was a repeated visitor to that particular peninsula. The nearest restaurant to their house is a Chili's, which holds a great sentimental attachment to my family. And not only is Samir, friend of the show, no nickname for you, Sunshine, absolutely incensed and disgusted that great, great sentimental attachment to Chili's. I think it's actually a joke in the first couple of series of The Office that Michael Scott has such poor taste. He thinks Chili's is brilliant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it checks out. And also, just Central Florida?
Yeah.
Just America's dick. Like, just not.
It is. Yeah, it was on Channel 4 News this week. They were flying a helicopter over Central Florida looking for right-wing militias living in the woods. And I was like, I know my dad's got a bit more conservative as he's got older, but I hadn't realized things had got that bad.
Oh, yeah. No, it's pretty fun here. Living in Minneapolis last summer, we had white supremacists put Molotov cocktails in our alleys. Yeah, wow. Super fun. Super fun. Yeah. It's been a great year.
You have had a year.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
I lived like two blocks away from Lake Street, the one that got smoked up, but
oh my God.
Yeah. Yes. Sorry, I brought it down real fast.
It was always good. Like to down. It's fine. It's just really interesting.
White supremacy.
God damn it, Maddie.
I know. Blame the KKK.
It's always their fault.
It is.
Yeah. Although, to be fair, there's a reason they call it Florida Man Stories and not, yeah, you know, just like America Stories.
Have you heard the thing of if you type in Florida Man and your birthday, that's like your theme of like...
It's like your story.
Yeah.
No. I think
you'll have to do it later.
I'm doing it now.
Mine was a man who got mad at... He got kicked out of a strip club, got high on meth and like drove his car into a gas station.
Mine was Florida man claiming to be Alice in Wonderland says hookah smoking caterpillar told him to destroy liquor store with a forklift.
Yes.
Mine's someone that makes himself a snack while robbing a Taco Bell.
Oh, there we go.
Full circle.
Florida man arrested after pelting girlfriend with sweet and sour sauce packets from McDonald's.
There you go. See, those are somehow sometimes rare. So I think that's a felony now.
Florida man hit dad in face with pizza after learning he helped deliver him. I've no idea how that works as a sentence in English, never mind what the story's about.
I feel the need, as the most Floridian person here, to say that due to its sunshine laws, those stories are much easily more in the public domain due to the excellent freedom of speech laws they have in Florida, rather than Florida being particularly mental. Thank you. This has been a particularly raucous part of the state of Florida. But anyway, Samir, your nickname now is Florida Man. I hope you're happy.
I genuinely thought, John, you were going to say, as the most Floridian here, I just want to say, # not all Florida men.
Samir is very sensible.
# Chili's is the best.
And my dad is perhaps the most sensible man on earth. Right, so 1995 then. Lindsay Madison, you chose 1995 for the year we can kind of remember happening. Any particular reason for that?
Because Madison would actually be able to remember it because she's 6 years younger than me.
I was six at the time.
Oh, you're a baby. Sorry.
Yeah.
But you do remember some of these things, though.
I do remember some of them. I did the research this time, which is rare because normally I'm just here for the ride. So
same.
I freeload. Yeah, unapologetically. But
I'm high-fiving Lindsay downwards because that's where you are on my screen.
Can you do it side by side? No, I'm not going to get into that. Just
for me, it's working.
You've done every one except the one that I can see you high-fiving in the direction of.
Yeah, I didn't realize like how pretty trash it was of a year for the U.S.
For the U.S., it was particularly bad.
It was pretty terrible.
It was. So. That's what struck me doing my research was that for the UK, it was kind of a fallow year. Like, not a lot really went on, which is quite a Claire Robinson, like, nothing really happened in 1995.
1995 was a good year, TV-wise. We smashed it.
Yeah, absolutely. But America, very, very big year. Yeah. So, I mean, usually we go over to Claire Robinson as our 1995 correspondent, but as our guests, what were the things that you sort of remember happening in 1995?
Oh, boy. Should I go, Lindsay? Do you want me to reshare the document?
Wait, you've got a document? They're already much more prepared than we are.
We have a book.
Google Docs. Google Docs for life.
That's how we rock.
Lord Google, our Skynet savior.
I love you. I will say, in like the list that you pulled together, even though I was 12, I do remember it being a big deal when Calvin and Hobbes stopped putting out comics, because that was the year they stopped publishing new content.
Mm-hmm.
We call it content.
I know. It's like that they ended their YouTube channel or something.
I know. Slap that bell. Subscribe.
I would watch a Calvin and Hobbes YouTube channel, which would just be, like, especially these days, like a 40-year-old man talking to his stuffed animal. I would love.
Oh my
God, it would be an old man with like showing the comic books, doing the voices of it, yeah. And it's like slightly blurred, and also he's reading it too fast, so you can't follow with the comics, and you're like
jaggedy. He moves the paper around a lot.
Yeah.
Always on the side of the teacher or Calvin's dad, who was sometimes quite sensible and kind, but for the most part, you know, a bit of an antagonist. But the old guy would be like, what are you talking about, Calvin? I don't know why I'm doing a really New York sort of accent. That might be offensive to somebody. Let's stop it there.
I mean, you're always offensive anyway, so just run with it.
Don't stop on our account. That's
I respect Bill Watterson by sticking to his guns, though, and just being like, this is the end of it. No franchising, no, like, making money off it, no bumper stickers or anything like that. I'm just drawing a line in the sand. I'm a massive comics nerd, by the way. Not just comic strips, but comics in general, hence the Superman reference. Yeah,
that's very unheard of in, like, the comic space. People not being like, oh, yeah, let's sell a bunch of merch and give the rights to the characters to a bunch of people to make whatever out of it. So, yeah, I also appreciate him for doing that. That was
mad props.
Pretty cool. Toy Story, the first one, came out in 95.
So early, isn't it?
It's crazy to think that it came out that long ago, considering the fourth one just came out, like, what, 3 years ago? Something like that?
Something like that.
It was technically the world's first computer-generated film. Mm-hmm. Like, fully computer generated.
I mean, the whole story I always tell about that is it's another like freaky time passing thing. Me and Constance Prelley, Ellie Kemper impersonated, took our niece to see Toy Story 3 when she must have been about 4 or 5. And she's going to college in the fall. Hey, I've picked it up. I can do it. which is already quite terrifying about the length of time we've been together. But obviously at the end when, like, you know, Andy gives his toys away, because he's going to college, I think, actually. That's the plot, isn't it?
Mm.
The last time. And it was kind of like me and her were bawling our eyes out about childhood passes.
Oh, yeah.
The passing of time. And, like, Emma was like, Uncle John, why are you crying?
Give it time and you'll know what this feels like.
You'll know what it means one day.
Yeah, we've spoken about a lot of upsetting things on this podcast, but I would say that's up there.
True story, I have a teddy bear that I've still had since I was an infant, and I did try to do the nice mom thing and, like, pass it on to my children at one point, and then when I didn't like how they were taking care of it, I took it back. I was like, no, Tommy deserves better than you.
So. I remember this and judged her harshly for it.
No. Hashtag Team Lindsay for that one, I'm afraid.
Yep. He deserves better. What else happened in that year? Oklahoma City bombing. That was a huge deal too.
I remember it very vividly because as we occasionally talk about on this podcast, my older sister was in the army and serving in Northern Ireland. I kind of lived my entire childhood in utter paranoia about her being killed by terrorists because it happened a lot to serving British military forces in those days, particularly those in Northern Ireland. But my mum worked for the Department of Social Security. So I was less worried about her until the Oklahoma City bombing. And of course, I was confronted with the idea that my mum was also at risk of terrorists, apparently. So yeah, very much do remember that one.
I remember when they did the raid on where he was hiding and like watching the footage of them.
Yeah. You know,
pulling him out, taking him away in handcuffs and stuff. Like, I remember watching that. And then, of course, you know, OJ, that being the OJ trial taking place in 95.
That's one of the things that I most remember was that our family was in Florida, obviously, because I was a child at that time and demanded to go to Disney World like any sensible child does. And we were there when the chase happened. And I just remember watching that on live TV and then hearing constant news updates in between constant replays of John Cougar Mellencamp's Jack and Diane, which seemed to be the song of the summer that year for some reason. I mean, don't get me wrong, it's a tune. But yeah, that OJ, especially the chase stuck in my mind, and then the trial when he... he got acquitted and definitely didn't do it.
Wink, wink.
Totally.
Yeah. I actually remember watching the trial because at that time I wasn't allowed to be home by myself in the summer because I wasn't old enough to not burn the house down. And so I had to go to daycare with Madison, obviously, but I didn't have to do nap time because I was too big. So I got to watch the OJ Simpson trial.
Have to.
Who watched us. I didn't have to. Now I wish I would have, now that I know how awesome naps are. I wish I could go back in time and be like, just take the nap, man. You're going to wish you could have 20 years in the future. So I remember watching it. And the famous, if it doesn't fit, you must acquit with the glove. Yep.
Yeah.
My recollection of that one was that the highlights were on British TV every day at 9 o'clock on BBC Two, which... It doesn't really make any sense, really, because the American football to you, is still not very big here. It's only people like...
No, we have the NFL in London now. Like...
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah, the NFL comes over to London once a year.
They kind of put the Super Bowl on as a sop to anybody American who might be living in England and just be like, there you go. Yeah, we've put it on. You can't say we haven't now. But they will have several... long days of just snooker in primetime TV with two men just doing that with some balls.
Exactly. If you went to a Chili's, every screen would not be showing snooker if this was Britain. Exactly. So we only really know OJ Simpson in this country, at least then, for his role in the Naked Gun films.
Yeah.
So it would be kind of like, to me, like if everyday American television is showing... Stan Collymore has never been accused of murder. Stan Collymore was on trial for murder and every day American TV was watching it because he was in Basic Instinct 2. Which he was.
What else? You found a really interesting story, Maddie. I don't
know. Oh, yeah. I asked our parents if they remembered this and Dad just went, yeah. So it's Sean Nelson went on a tank rampage in San Diego, California. He was an American plumber and U.S. Army vet who had just the worst time in the late 80s and early 90s. His mom died in 1988. His dad died in 92. His wife divorced him in 1990. And that same year in 1990, he was in a really awful motorcycle accident. And that was kind of the turning point, essentially, for a lot of his stuff. He tried suing the hospital for negligence, assault, battery, and false imprisonment. And then like a Supreme Court judge was like, no, you weren't. This is fake. And so then shortly after his hospitalization, he became addicted to meth, as one does, and dug a 15-foot hole in his backyard to search for gold. So,
as California.
I mean, why wouldn't you? A week before his tank rampage, he told a friend that he wanted to commit suicide, and he thought the Oklahoma bombing was cool. One night at 6 p.m., he just drives his van into the National Guard Armory in San Diego because the gate was open and nobody was around.
The 90s.
Like a week after the Oklahoma City bombings, all of the tanks and like everything just open at 6 p.m. in San Diego. No big deal. So he took his time and he went into one tank and started it because it's essentially push to start. You don't need a key. And it didn't work. So he hops out and he goes to another one. And that one didn't work. And so he hopped into a third one. And finally, some idiot shows up and is like, hey, you don't belong here. Too late. That one starts. So he's like, see you later, asshole. And he drives off.
Very and, like, slowly.
It's a top speed of 30 miles per hour. So they called the police and he did a 20-minute chase where he just decimated like stop signs, road signs, traffic lights, utility poles, fire hydrants. He crushed 40 vehicles, including an RV.
Wow.
And then just started going towards, like he went on a highway, and it's theorized that he was actually trying to get to the hospital where he was, because that was also the same hospital that his mom died at. And he was blaming them for her death. And then like for him being fucked up, even though I'm pretty sure it was the meth, but I could be wrong. So he got stuck on a median trying to like turn to go onto another highway. And that's when the police were able to like bolt cut it open. And they're like, you got to get out. And he's like, no, I'm not getting out. And so they shot him in the neck. And then there was this huge thing about like, you shouldn't have killed him. Like that was so cruel. And they were like, listen, we didn't know how to get the tank to stop. And there were 35 cars with people in them that he would have crushed. Mm-hmm. And so they were like, no, fuck off. We shot him in the neck. And honestly, he wanted to die. So
yeah,
he literally went out with a bang.
He sounds like he'd get on great with Albert Dryden.
He would love to hang out with Albert Dryden.
I love how he Goldilocks his way through those tanks. Like this one,
this one doesn't fit. The only golden, like the silver lining of this is it didn't have any ammunition because they kept the ammunition in another room. And I was like, wow, great forethought. At least you have that. I don't know why you don't know how gates work, but like, thank God you have another room for your ammunition. God bless America. It was really interesting.
I don't remember it at all, but I did come across it and it's absolutely wild that he stole a tank and tried to destroy San Diego. And he was able to do that because there was no gates between the tanks and the main road, and tanks are button start, apparently.
Push to start tanks.
Like you have to get your car keys out and like.
I suppose it kind of makes sense because if you're in like enemy territory, you need that to just push and go.
I put the keys in. Shit.
Right. Just won't turn over.
It's the wrong tank key. It's actually for the Humvee over there. And he woke up and chose violence. He did a good job. Like the utility poles and stuff that he took out, it took them a very long time to get that back. And all I can think of is that poor person with the RV, were they retired, like newly retired? And then like some asshat just like literally crushes their dreams with the RV being destroyed. All I can think of.
But on the other hand, maybe they were really racist. So they didn't deserve the RV.
Could happen.
Anyway.
Guess we're so not going to Florida, kids. Sorry.
No Florida man for them.
Life, no injury with that story. Purely property damage.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you've got a tank, that's going to be a swing and a miss, surely.
Well, at a top speed of 30 miles per hour, I feel like you could see it coming and be like, I should probably move. And then you would just...
Yeah, I suppose there weren't that many people.
He's coming straight for us. Oh, very slowly.
Oh, no.
Britain was a lot quieter in 1995. I did ask Constance Prelli, Ellie Kemper, what she remembered about the year. And her key memory was dancing to R. Kelly's Bump and Grind at a roller disco for my 12th birthday.
Nice.
12 years old, of course, ironically being the age at which R. Kelly stops being interested.
Fair.
Yeah.
Fair.
Yeah.
The only thing to bridge the transatlantic gap that I can think of in 1995 was that it was the year that the American sitcom Caroline in the City debuted.
That was so good!
Leah Thompson.
That was a good one.
That was the most middle of the road sitcom that you can imagine, up there with, I think I've mentioned before on this podcast, weirdly, Veronica's Closet. But it was a quite an apt choice of my very brief sojourn into sitcoms, because it obviously had in the first series two crossovers with other sitcoms, namely Friends, when Chandler showed up for no real reason in one of the episodes, and then later on in episode 4 of series 1 when Niles and Daphne from Frasier showed up. There's literally nothing in it. Leah Thompson, Caroline in the City, a cartoonist, another, I guess, link to my passions, Leah Thompson not being one of them.
Yeah. Why the hell not?
I think I'm still just too creeped out with her trying to shag her own son in Back to the Future. It's just weird. No, not for me.
Wasn't she also the actress that tried to screw the duck and Howard the Duck, too?
She was indeed. Yeah.
Yes.
She was.
Yep.
Weird sexual fetishes. That's not okay.
So, yeah, not keen to go there with Leah Thompson. Thank you very much. But, yeah, Caroline in the City. Don't really seek it out because it's honestly not that good.
And, of course, in the episode, she decides she's never going to write the strip ever again, and she's also not going to allow any merchandising to happen. A lot of integrity, to be fair, Caroline, in the City.
But what you don't realise, John, is that there are a lot of knockoff bumper stickers of Caroline just pissing.
Or praying to Jesus, praying to God. That's a popular one here in the States.
If you know, yeah. Or praying while peeing. Peeing on liberals, and then when he prays, his shadow is a cross.
That's nice. But he's definitely owning them libs by peeing on them, so that's...
Absolutely.
Going full R. Kelly, full circle. There we go.
There we go.
Very true.
Claire, please take us away from this dark, dark hole.
Okay. So my chat about 1995 is a little bit different. In football news, we had, close to home, we had Andy Cole, who was sold to Manchester United from Newcastle for, I'm going to need help on this one, 7000000. I don't know how to pronounce that in numerical form.
7000000, are you saying?
Yeah.
£7 million.
7000000.
Yeah. 7 million
for a human to play football.
Well, that's just soccer. A drop in the bucket.
Like, can we address how wrong that is?
It's very wrong, but it happens all the time.
I mean, it was only 1995 that Mississippi ratified the 13th Amendment. So humans did used to be quite a lot cheaper prior to this, to be fair.
Actually, it wasn't official until 2013.
Is it not?
Wow.
I can attest Mississippi is trash. So
we're
we've got no listeners there. I'll check today.
So that apparently was the highest ever transfer fee. But that year, they then repeatedly just kept adding more knots and knots and knots on it. So Dennis Bergkamp, who actually when... I was younger, my brother's a passionate Arsenal fan, and he was a big Bergkamp fan to the point that he had posters and stickers and all of the like random memorabilia that came with that. But yeah, he added a 5 onto that one. So it was 7.5. So it was 7.5 million. There we go. Nailed it. I can do math.
How many zeros were there on the end? Because if it was still 000000, then it was £75 million and
hang
not
on.
7.5.
It was 7500000.
That's the correct number of zeros for it to be reasonable. Well done, Claire.
Hurrah, I can do math.
You could have just said 5 zeros and six zeros. Then you would have learned maths, but, you know.
I mean, this is a kid who used to be put in a corner because I couldn't do simple sums. So, you know, my education didn't support me with this challenge.
And then Stan Collymore went for 8 million. And that's the second time we've mentioned Stan Collymore tonight, which I don't think anyone was expecting.
In other football chat, Eric Cantona managed to assault a spectator at a football match and he was sentenced to 14 days in prison, but somehow managed to get that reduced to 120 hours of community service. And that ends the football chat from this year.
Since you've mentioned his strike partner at Manchester United, who did not start very well, let's bring back a 25-year-old joke. Why does Eric Cantona play with his collar up?
I don't know why.
Because he's been carrying coal all season.
I'm very sorry, guys.
It was a great joke in 1995. This has now
descended into a football podcast. The worst of all podcasts.
I mean, this is just Tumbleweed City at the minute, isn't it?
But this, John. That's fine. That's been lost in the edit, mate. Come on.
The one thing I really vividly remember is that this was the year that Leah Betts died of ecstasy. But actually, she didn't. Yes, she took ecstasy, but actually she died from the amount of water that she consumed after she took the pill. But we had all of the propaganda of ecstasy's dangerous. And we know ecstasy's dangerous. But like, guys, she died from water.
So a 17-year-old girl called Leah Betts took an ecstasy at a house party. And then she ended up in a coma for about a week. And in that time, an iconic photo of her and a life support machine was taken. And that was made into posters. And they put them up literally everywhere that week. There's like a drugs warning and they were in my science room. And then one lesson, my chemistry teacher, Mr. Lateef, came in and just wrote RIP across the top to highlight the fact that she had passed away. She'd lost the fight. And I was speaking to Mr. Lateef on Twitter today because it stayed with me as like an iconic moment of my education. But like, as the guys were saying, interestingly, point is it was actually wonky drugs education that killed her rather than the drugs, because she'd been told that ecstasy makes you dehydrate. So you've got to drink a lot when you're taking it. But that's based on the idea that you're in a very hot nightclub and you're dancing for hours and hours and hours. But she was actually at a house party. So in fact, she wasn't dehydrating. In fact, died of water intoxication instead. But as a result of this, our school cancelled a whole day of lessons to spend the whole day drilling us on sex and drugs, which is not as fun as it sounds.
No.
So I've had two memories that have come flooding back of that particular day. First of all, my particular education was done split gender, of course, by my phys ed teacher. And again, I've done it.
You're not cool just because you know I'm the American to be lingo.
Inclusive. My PE teacher.
Thank you.
He began the lesson with this phrase: "Listen, boys, any idiot can get a girl pregnant. It takes a smart one not to."
Fair. Mm-hmm.
It's like the British version of Mean Girls.
Absolutely. He then
if you have sex, you'll die.
he then taught us how to put a condom on a banana behind our backs, which, I've got to be honest, it's not a skill I've ever had to deploy in the field.
Did he understand how anatomy worked? Like, I don't think it's located back there.
But yeah, definitely a bet. Definitely something alarming.
What else did I have from 1995? In kids' TV news, because that's always my favourite, we had the launch of Kissy Fur, which was a TV show about two bears who were part of a circus. The circus train crashed and they were abandoned in the woods. It's really, really good. And I remember watching it on a Saturday morning.
I do remember Kissy Fur himself.
Sounds like a Victorian euphemism.
No, it's so good.
It does.
It's a really good show. I remember it really vividly, and everyone needs to watch it. It's amazing. And they used to eat cake in it, and the cake looked amazing as well. Don't ask me why I'm spiraling off on this one. And it was the end of Krypton Factor, Bullseye, Challenge Annika. It was the end of the animals of Farthingwood.
And thank Christ for that. We've now alienated our two guests quite considerably. So,
yeah, I'm really sorry about that.
I have a rebuttal of things you might not know. Mm-hmm. Or maybe you will. I don't know. eBay was launched.
Oh my God, really? 1995?
95.
Jesus.
The Animaniacs moved from Kids WB to Fox Kids. That was a huge deal.
Yeah.
In the US, apparently. I don't know.
And the History Channel also debuted in 95, which is funny because they've already run out of history and just have like the swamp people on TV now.
So yours just has very bad reality TV.
Yeah, it's aliens and then swamp people. Do you watch Swamp People?
It's really good. I watch it on Amazon Prime and it's amazing.
You can't understand a word these people say. It's like a Southern Creole accent. And it's just about these people who live in the swamp and hunt alligators.
The subtitles constantly, because I'm just like, what are the fuck are they saying?
A bit like we are with you, Claire.
Yes, literally, it's the same, just with more hair.
The History Channel in the UK definitely shows ancient aliens or whatever, if that's the nonsense that you're talking about. Other than that, it literally just shows World War II things like, these are the tanks that defeated Hitler. There must be somebody somewhere that just sits there all day and is like, oh, I need to watch Hitler's next super weapon again. Oh, my God.
You need to watch it. It's a good time.
Swamp People is the feel-good show of the summer. You should really tune in. The movies that came out in the U.S. in 95, Batman Forever, Apollo 13, Pocahontas, Ace Ventura, When Nature Calls.
Oh, my God. So good.
GoldenEye. Casper, Jumanji, Die Hard with a Vengeance, and Braveheart.
A golden age of cinema.
It was a good year.
It was.
And we actually... Casper is a children's cartoon, which the whole starting point is the death of a child.
Yeah, it's super dark in the beginning. Yeah.
I know.
Very bleak.
And then a very lonely girl whose only friend is a ghost, a dead
child. And don't forget his three abusive uncles.
Yes. Oh my god,
the 90s were, well, Jumanji, does anybody actually remember oh, it's so fun. You're messed up.
We usually have a section where we do a Gareth reminds us of a sitcom, a long forgotten sitcom of the era, which I believe he's done with Caroline in the City.
Right,
but on the same thing, I came across tonight on the same thing. We have a sitcom which I very much doubt made the trip, although it's odd because the first time I went to America in 1995, everyone was talking about how much they loved Keeping Up Appearances.
That
was the sitcom that traveled.
It was, but it was only at like 2 a.m. We had a TV in Lindsay's room with a Sega, and because you couldn't save, we would just turn the TV off.
Yeah.
So our parents thought that it was off.
Yeah.
But there were times where like they'd find out and turn it off, and then when we turned the TV on. That was one of the shows that was always on. The
reason for mentioning it was we had a sitcom that started in 1975, which is called Next of Kin, which I hadn't remembered. Mm. It starred Penelope Keith, who's a legendary sitcom actor. And the sit for this com is there is a retired couple, and one day their son and his wife are killed in a car crash, meaning that they have to raise their estranged grandchildren, even though they don't want to. Humor arises from this situation.
I'm glad it's humor.
The same as Ever Decreasing Circles with Richard Briers, the sit being that he's got dementia, quite severe dementia, and then has to move back in with his son and wife, who don't really want him there, but he's just going increasingly and increasingly mentally ill throughout the entire thing before, I believe, in the final episode, he actually dies. And it's just, and the humor derives from the fact that he's got dementia.
He can't remember anything.
Exactly. But it's, to be fair, it is treated slightly more sensitively than I've just suggested. But even so, dear God, what were we doing? Anyway. Yeah.
I can't believe that no one has mentioned January 25th when the world almost ended.
I know, that didn't make it onto my list. Although one tiny, tiny little thing just to finish off with before we spiral off, because, this was the year that Jill Dandor debuted on Crime Watch. And ironically, many years later, she would then be murdered and feature on Crime Watch. So, full circle!
Bummer. Damn.
Is that something which is so, I guess, striking that that has made the trip over the Atlantic, that story? So
the murder of a little bit.
Very long running, true crime, I guess,
crime
programme. There's on once a month on BBC One, which they would do reconstructions, America's Most Wanted, basically the same thing, same format called Crime Watch.
Slash Unsolved Mysteries.
Slash Unsolved Mysteries. one of the presenters was a woman called Jill Dando, who was herself murdered. And weirdly, they did, so they did a reconstruction of themselves like a month after it happened, which is just crazy again. Like, that was where TV was in 99, I think that was.
Very years meta. About,
but yeah, very meta, not in a fun way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, briefly, because I've forgotten too. January the 25th, Norwegian scientists launched a rocket up to study Aurora Borealis, and they flew it right over Moscow, causing the Russians to prepare for a retaliatory strike on America. Including bringing the nuclear button to Boris Yeltsin, who was probably drunk at the time. But good news is we're all still here.
That's good.
We got to see Jupiter that year for an hour.
For an hour?
Good.
Yeah, NASA's Galileo spacecraft finally got to Jupiter and transmitted an hour of data before it stopped functioning. And then it actually didn't land on Jupiter for another 2 years. It was just stuck
in the gas. Atmosphere.
Yeah.
All the swirling storm gas.
Is what it feels like being on this podcast, just stuck in all of the swirling gas of John's ideas, never really landing, but you know, you'll keep at it, by God.
Oh, man.
Rude.
Sign off from 1995, by the way, is, if you're wondering what it was like in the UK in that year, Bronn from Game of Thrones spent a combined 11 weeks at number one with covers of The Righteous Brothers and Latterly the Drifters.
Didn't he sing that song, oh God, Up on the Roof? He was part of a band,
that was,
right?
That was his second one. He had 4 weeks with that and 7 weeks with Unchained Melody, Top of the Charts.
That song, my husband, he's kind of cruel to our kids. And so he found that song and he would play it super loud to wake up the girls in the morning for school. He would just, like, out of the blue, you'd hear really loud, Up on the Roof. And the first day he did it, my oldest came out and she's like, what the hell is happening? She was just so upset.
Why that song particularly? Version, though, the
definitive Robson and Jerome version.
Robson Green.
I think he did it because at the time we were watching Game of Thrones and it reminded him that he was in the band. And so he like found the song. Yeah, he did it like every day for like 2 weeks before I think my daughter was like, I will cut you if you keep doing this.
That sounds about right. Yeah.
So he was like, fair, I'll stop.
My version of that is Behind Blue Eyes by The Who. It's a tribute to Bill Hicks, who did it quite a lot. It's also actually about crime in England versus crime in America, the bit it comes from. Whenever he's sulking and I think he's being unreasonable, I start going, nobody knows what it's like to be nowhere.
I love how
he doesn't like it.
How fun it is to be a vindictive parent.
Oh, yeah.
Kids are just being little shits. It's so fun. They don't tell you that before you have children, that you get to have all this fun and make their lives miserable and make fun of them when they're being sad.
I mean, this definitely needs a trigger warning child abuse in the description, John.
Have
we reached the end of 1995? Because
I think we have.
It's about time I leave a reminder for myself to put the disclaimer in. But I mean, I guess if you're affected by events that happened in 1825, I think it's a bit late for that.
Are you a time traveler?
Don't get me or Gareth started on that.
Okay,
Claire loves it when we talk Doctor Who, don't you, Claire?
I mean, I thought we were going to make a full podcast without a Doctor Who reference, but you had to slide it in there, didn't you? That's what she said!
Well done. Well done.
Yes, so the reason we invited our American friends on this was not for that vulgarity, Claire Robinson, meant to be a cultural ambassador to our nation.
I'm the one who picks up roadkill and, like, yeah, I'm not the cultural ambassador here, let's be honest.
To our American friends, picks up roadkill isn't a suggestion that she dresses up like a woman of the night and stands by the side of the road waiting for drunks to come up and kiss her.
Although that is also true.
Rude. Love you, really.
Anyway, shall we give our guests some chance to speak?
Yes.
Yeah. So, yes, the reason we invited our American friends on tonight was to change of pace. Instead of having our usual Northeast crime of the 80s and 90s. I noticed when I was listening to you guys' excellent pod, you have visited the Northeast twice. Again, the first time was to look at Mary Ann Cotton, which is a serial killer of the Victorian era, whose house I drive past on my way to work every day. But obviously, due to our absurdly restrictive remit, we've given ourselves, I'll rephrase that, I gave us, we will never be able to cover. But you've also done a crime I'd never, ever heard of. Despite the fact, as we were saying earlier, this is a slightly got some coverage locally recently because we have a huge open air museum very close to where I live called Beamish. I'm assuming you get the idea of an open air museum. It's basically, it's a huge museum that's meant to be like physically visiting how...
Like a living museum.
Yeah, the living museum. So the living museum in the north. So how, where we live would look like at various periods of history.
John, it's like if Disneyland didn't have any fun in it. That's
Disneyland
what it
doesn't have any fun in it?
It'd be comparative to in America where they have like colonial Williamsburg.
Yeah. This is what where you live would have looked like 100 years ago, 150 years ago, 200 years ago. So this is the story of Joe the Quilter, who they have very recently rebuilt in entirety the house of Joe the Quilter in Beamish, so people can see what a Northumberland quilter's house looked like in the 1820s. But I had never heard of this story, despite the fact that, I mean, at this time of day, I could be at Beamish in probably 10 to 15 minutes until the sun went down while we were recording this. I was looking at Northumberland, and now I'm looking at where Northumberland is, and you are slightly less than 4,000 miles away from this particular area, but you were the ones that found this story. I'm completely unaware of it. Madison and Lindsay, please take us through the sad story of Joe the Quilter.
Yes, I would love to. So Joe the Quilter was known as Joseph Headley, was really well-liked and well-known in, is it Warden, Northumberland?
Yes.
See, now I'm going to be all like nervous because I'm actually like on a show with actual English people. So if I screw up the names of stuff.
I'm going to look at the map now, right? Because there was one I was looking at to pitch where this was happening. And I was like, oh, I bet they're going to get that one very badly wrong. But I can't remember it is now.
We have a corrections cubby. And when things are like, we have difficult European names, we're like, we're just going to open this. And we're just going to preemptively say, sorry.
And you guys like to do like upon blank, like a lot of your names are like something upon blank, and both the like bookend words are always very difficult to say, so that I'm sitting there like, I know the middle one, so I know I'll get that one right.
Yeah, but why couldn't you just use Texas?
God. It's all right, I'm feeling your pain, having recently moved to Scotland, and really in the north of Scotland where they've still got a lot of the original Gaelic. It's like, even if the word is obvious, like P-O-R-T-R-E-E is portree, but everybody will pronounce it as portree. And you're like, where did the other consonants and vowels go? So, you know, I totally get you. I totally get you. And I feel like a sham as well. So we're all on the same page.
Correct me where I screw up.
I'm Lurkle, as we call it. And there's a place near where Claire's from called Isetburn. Did I get that right? Which is
Isetburn.
Nothing like Isaac Byrne, and it, I have to think every time it comes up, which isn't often, to be fair.
Good luck and Godspeed.
Yeah. Well, one fun one from our childhood, actually, was we come from a town called Lamar's. It's a Blue Bunny ice cream capital of the world. And people think it's French, and they're like, oh, it's Lamar. And it's like, no, it's literally the initials of women who were on a train once that went through the town. And they're like, you should name the town. And they couldn't decide. So they're like, what are your initials? And they just made them up.
That's really cool.
We have a place that's very near where Claire lives now, actually, which is called Pity Me, which is brilliant on signposts and gets a lot of people just going out to stand by the sign that says, Pity Me.
They used to have a McDonald's there. Oh, they still have a McDonald's there. But the McDonald's used to sell badges that said, I've been to McDonald's, pity me on them.
But that's I think, and Claire, if you correct me if I'm wrong, it was like a tributary of the Weir came out there and created some sort of big lake area. And there were French settlers at the time that called it Petit Mer.
Probably because I'm Beau Repair, which is...
Yeah, I'm Beau Repair,
yeah. Yeah, there was a lot of French things around Durham.
The French called it Little Sea due to the amount of water there was. And basically everyone was like, pity me, close enough. That's what we'll call it.
Fine. Yep.
It works. Well, it's like Des Moines from Iowa, where I was originally from. and everybody, because it's got S's at the end of it, everybody always says Des Moines.
Des Moines.
Yeah, it's Des Moines. Yeah.
It's so French and fancy. No, it's not.
I love Arkansas and Kansas, though. That will never cease to piss so many people off.
Kansas.
Yep.
Yeah.
Arkansas.
Had an argument with that once, and it's, you know, if you want to see me at my very worst, someone was insisting, a British person was insisting it's Arkansas. I was very much like, well, they were calling it Arkansas when I was there.
I don't know if I'd be proud saying that you went to Arkansas, but good on you.
I insisted because we were in Memphis, which is obviously a place you would go to. And I was like, we can literally see Arkansas by here. I'm not going to be here and not go over into Arkansas, just so if I'm on a podcast in 10 years time, I can say, yeah, I can impress my friends into Arkansas.
And I know how to say it. So back to Warden Northumberland, now that we've gone to the U.S. and back again. Joe lived by himself in this like little two-room thatch roof cottage. And it'd be the same place that he was basically birthed in 1750. Mm. Like you mentioned, the recreation of that is at Beamish. So you can actually go in there and see just how small this little house was that he lived in. And if you can imagine like living there with a family, that's like terrifying. But he apprenticed as a tailor, but he didn't end up doing very well with that trade just because it wasn't his skill set. He was very adept at quilting, so that's what he took up. He was really good at decorative stitching, intricate floral patterns, putting in figures, geometric shapes, and he actually has a specific style that he would use called Old Joe's Chain, which is a border pattern that he became famous for. So now you can see it, and his quilts are worth like thousands of pounds based off this chain that was extremely intricate.
Yes. How many zeros does that have after it? Can we just make sure that it's thousands rather than millions? Or
thousands. It'd be like three zeros if it was
1, okay, 000. Good. Three, yeah. Mm-hmm. Hear that, Claire? Three zeros.
Fucking three twice. Thousands.
I'm also bad at math, but I'm pretty good at zeros.
Carry on.
No, that's fine. So even though he like ended up being really famous for this quilt, you know, he was actually extremely poor and he had to rely on the generosity of his neighbors and the parish to be able to sustain himself. And he at one point had a wife named Isabel that was 25 years his senior. It was written that she was bedridden for at least 8 years before she passed away. And during that time, he just spent all of his time taking care of her. He wasn't doing anything like his craft. So he would spend his time tending to the garden. They had chickens that he would look after. And because where his cottage was kind of like on the way in between a few towns, they would allow travelers and peddlers to stay with them just as a warm place to stay for people, basically. So at the point that this story takes place, he had given up quilting because he couldn't see very well. So he was pretty much blind and penniless, which is very sad. He was last seen alive on January 3rd, 1826. And on his way home, he'd obtained a pitcher of milk, a pound of sugar, a sheep's head, which sounds disgusting, and
not to Gary.
I'm in Scotland now. We literally eat sheep's heads for breakfast in Scotland, so that's fine by me.
Nope.
How?
Depending on what haggis you get, the tongue is a part of offal that gets ground down to make the haggis. So it could be, I mean, it's guts, but it's also tongue. We don't just have a sheep's head on a plate. We're not monsters.
I know, which is why I asked. I was like, what do you take from the head?
No, we just have a sheep's head on toast. Eat it all. Just cut it up, slice of toast, plop a sheep's head on it. All good.
You can modernize it by also adding avocado and some like everything bagel seasoning.
Back seed.
It's the next thing for Trader Joe's.
Yeah.
Just take it to a whole new hipster level of.
I was just thinking the thing that I need on this idyllic island is an influx of hipsters. I leave some out with some milk overnight, and then some guys with waxed mustaches and beards will turn up, and nature will be restored again.
As long as it's oat milk.
Of course, yeah. They're not vegan. They're just arseholes.
He also obtained some pluck, which, as you mentioned, is basically awful. Awful?
It is awful.
Awful.
I mean, it sounds awful because it's just internal organs and cast off, ground up.
Delicious.
Nice times. Nice times.
I once went to a restaurant in Edinburgh called The Dog that was quite famous for its awful.
Serving dogs.
No, he had two whippets and he was a nice guy. And one of the starters was lamb's heart on toast. So I, and being quite not squeamish about that, I thought, I'll give that a go. But I thought it had come like nicely sliced on whatever. No, it was literally just two slices of bread with somebody that taken a lamb's heart, cut it in half, like broiled it and whacked it on the toast. So it still had its ventricles. It still had blood inside it that had essentially turned to black pudding or blood pudding for the Americans. And other than all of the tubes, it was genuinely one of the nicest things I've ever eaten.
You make it sound so delightful.
Wow. People say English food is bad. Come on.
You literally ate someone's heart out. That's...
Yeah. Wow. It came like it was like the bit from Snow White where the huntsman presents the heart to the queen, but yeah. Lovely. Anyway, sorry. I realize I'm derailing this significantly.
It's okay. You were the huntsman with toast. You were like here.
Yeah. But you can't be keto then. Bummer.
Yeah. He'd gotten all that from his neighbor, Mrs. Colbeck, so she was the last person to see him alive. And around 6 that night, William Herman, who was a laborer at the local paper mill, he paid Joe a visit on his way home because he was walking his way to Wall. So where's Wall at?
I've just realized this is actually where my parents grew up. And the paper mill still exists to this day, and it's called Four Stones Paper Mill now. And one of my cousins works there.
Really?
And Wall is the location that joins Hadrian's Wall, and it's the way that it transects through, because my parents, one of them grew up on Wall Town, which is a farm which is on that landscape.
Friend of the podcast, Bex Lindsay, who also has her own podcast, Getting Emotional, grew up in Wall, and her parents used to own the pub in Wall. And yeah, no, so she is well acquainted with Wall, but equally... It is also the name of that village from Stardust. So that's...
Yeah. And yet Lindsay and Madison were the ones that got this story first. Well done, everyone.
I blame Bex Lindsay for doing a podcast about...
Bex Lindsay and her very successful podcast.
Get in the Guardian.
So William had stopped to visit Joe on his way to Wall from work at the paper mill. He said that when he visited, Joe was making potatoes for supper, and he had a really nice fire going in the hearth. So that was at 6 p.m. And around 7, about an hour later, a female peddler from Stamfordham.
That's the one.
Stamfordham, named Mrs. Biggs. She knocked on Joe's door to ask for directions to Four Stones, which I don't know where that is, because she'd lost her way in the dark, because obviously there's no like light posts in the 1750s, early 1800s.
Sorry, did you say her name was Mrs. Biggs?
Mrs. Biggs.
Lineage there.
So after...
never mind. Because nobody in organized crime was ever called Biggs, were they not?
Oh! We're not a real true crime podcast, are we?
I try. Anyway, carry on.
So he gave her directions and he sent her on her way. And she was actually the last person other than the murderer who saw Joe alive. So around 8 o'clock, Mr. Smith of Houghton Castle?
Yeah, Houghton Castle, yeah.
He rode past Joe's cottage on his way home, and he saw that the cottage was dark, and it was really quiet. And so based off that, they believe Joe was murdered between about 7 and 8. And none of his neighbors had seen or heard from him for 4 days. And at that time, they quickly broke down his locked door, and it was carnage. His cottage was in complete disarray. There was bloodstains all over the walls. They found a stretched out frame with the quilt that had a bloody handprint on it. And the items that he had brought home from his neighbor, Mrs. Colbeck, were still sitting on the table. He hadn't even had a chance to touch them yet. So I'm sure the awful smelled awful at that point. They found Joe in the back room where he would store his firewood and keep his chickens. And there was a pool of blood under him. And some reports that I found said that they found him in the outhouse, but I actually found actual illustrations of the crime scene where they noted him inside the cottage, so that's what I'm going with. I think the outhouse bit was to add more drama. Like, oh, he was in the shitter. How rude. How cruel could they be?
Again, where are you finding these illustrations from? Were they in the illustrated news of that time, or what was the source of it? Where is the source of most of this? I'm not suggesting you're making it up for one second,
no,
by the way.
No,
that was very accusatory, didn't it?
No, it's fine. So I pulled information from a Mental Floss article. There was a BBC news article, the Northern Echo, Northumberland Archives, a history blog article. So that's the history website. And Hexham Courant?
Courant.
Courant. Yeah. I was so close.
It is an absolutely mad name for a newspaper, even by our standards.
Yes.
I don't know what a Courant is. I think it's a seabird, isn't it? Or is that a cormorant?
That's a cormorant.
is Courant like a fruit? Is it a fruit?
I'm going to Google it.
There's a current.
A current. Is it a fruit?
It's a Courant.
Yeah, but my understanding, Gareth, is that it's like this was such a big deal, I'm sure we're going to get to at the time, that that's why his house was at Beamish and not any other quilter of the day, because like there were songs written, there were postcards.
I'm just curious,
that it was really big and there's lots of archive material out there, which there aren't for Northumberland quilters of this era.
I get it. Yeah. I'm just curious as to the accounts versus the illustrations was, I guess, my main thrust.
Yeah, I think what they ended up doing is they ended up making the illustrations so that later on, when they were trying to put together like a court case to try somebody for his actual murder, they could actually place, okay, this is where he was in his house, this is what happened. And it was either the Beamish website or one of the other, it might have been the Northumberland Archives article that had the actual illustrations that I was able to see. So his head, neck, and face were covered in slashes, and his hands held a number of defensive wounds, which showed that he'd tried to fight off his attacker and protect himself. At the end of it, he'd been slashed 44 times by a sharp object.
Jesus.
And they believe the murder weapon was a bloody garden hoe that was found by his body. And he was 76 years old. So this was like a very old man to attack so brutally.
And he was already blind and...
he couldn't really see. Like I said, the inside of the cottage painted a picture of the brutal attack. The bed tester was torn down, and that's the covering on the canopy bed, like curtains, like the wrought iron canopy beds. The face of his grandfather's clock had been smashed in. There was blood on the door, the chimney, the plates that were on the table, not to mention, you know, like the walls and the floor. And his clogs were actually found outside as if he had tried to get away from his attacker. And his clothes were covered in mud. So they think that he had tried to run outside to get help, and then his attacker had dragged him back in the house to finish the job. His cottage was completely ransacked. Like, drawers were opened, containers were upended, and items that weren't basically found to have much worth were turned over. The only real items of worth that he possessed, which were 2 silver tablespoons, 4 teaspoons, and 2 silver salt cellars, were the only items that were stolen. So the 1891 issue of the Monthly Chronicle of North Country Lore and Legend, mouthful of a newspaper, stated, quote, "The only possible motive for the crime was considered to have been a hope of securing money, as it was foolishly believed that old Joe was rich, although he was receiving parish relief. And several rewards were offered for any information that would lead to an arrest, including one from the overseers of the poor, who offered 100 guineas for information about the killer. And when I converted that, it ended up being just under £11,000 today. And they put up that reward on January 17th, 1826. And going back to what John mentioned, Robert Peel, who was the Home Secretary, offered a full pardon on behalf of His Majesty George IV for any accomplices who came forward with information on the killer.
Is that normal, though? Like, that sounds really, like, what, like, I don't know, I'm just asking. But, like, is it normal for the Home Secretary to be like, I'm going to let people have pardon if we find out? Like, why would they get involved with a random murder of a quilter in the middle of the northeast of England?
I know, that's a little strange.
One of the reasons might be, and I don't know the timeline of this, but Robert Peel was the first person to introduce the British police force, wasn't he? Hence why they're called Bobbies and or Peelers. So I suspect it may, and I don't know, again, I don't know the timeline of this, but it may have had something to do with the fact that Robert Peel was either trying to, this gave him the inspiration to do that, or was trying to legitimise the use of police in an organised way. But again, I could be talking absolute rubbish, but I usually do.
Yeah, how I interpreted it, and I've no idea if this is any truth at all, is that Peel was very ambitious, a politician. And I'm judging him by today's standards. But like, he was quite a young Home Secretary and then later quite a young Prime Minister. So this was a big deal media-wise. Like, you know, it was the same popular songs, postcards, stories, the horrific crime. So it was a big deal on a national level at a time where, you know, there was a national media for the first time. So it could well be that the Home Secretary of the day wanted to jump on it and be like, hey, I'm really big on solving crime, me. I'm all over this, because he was quite like a modern, progressive, ambitious politician of the day. So he made a big deal of it as Home Secretary because he thought it was good for him. I know that we're still a good 40 years away from any kind of democracy, so it's not like there are votes in it or anyway. Famously, Robert Peel was MP for Oxford University. It's in those days, if you're a university, you got an MP. You return someone to Parliament, and we're still probably about 40 years away from anywhere in the North getting an MP. But
so a jury convened and determined that the perpetrator had committed willful murder. And although several people were arrested and questioned, no one was ever formally charged with Joe's murder, which is still considered unsolved. He was buried in Warden Churchyard on January 10th, 1826. An auction was held on Wednesday, March 19th, 1826, to sell off what furniture of his remained. So all that was left of his earthly possessions was a dresser and shelves, one clock, one bed, one press, one kitchen table, and one corner cupboard. As John mentioned, around the time of his death, several penny dreadfuls had been published, describing in gruesome and embellished detail the story of his demise, an example of which was quoted in the Northern Echo as, quote, "They found the body of the murdered man, his gray hairs clotted with blood, his skull discolored with bruises, his face covered with gashes, and horrible to relate, his throat cut from ear to ear, evidently with a blunt instrument, all gashed and torn, the windpipe severed, the head hanging from the body."
But the good thing about those penny dreadfuls is that the illustrators of them never sold out to make merch off the back of them, or, you know, they said, this is the end of the penny dreadful now, I'm not going to do any more, which I respect.
We're going to say the tabloid journalist was coming in here to go like, yeah, they took some liberties with the truth, but that's a cracking write-up.
Shut up. I was a tabloid journalist for a mere 10 years to eat away at my soul.
10 years. So Joe's cottage was torn down about 46 years after his death in 1872. And by 1873, the location of where it once stood was lost. But fortunately, because of Beamish, the staff and members of the community of Warden were able to unearth clues on what his cottage may have looked like during an archaeological dig in the area. And they were able to kind of piece together what cottages of that time looked like based off postcards, historic auction records that detailed all the items that were sold after his death, and obviously all the articles that were written about the crime itself, the illustrations that were done of the interior of the cottage. And that's part of why Beamish was able to reconstruct a structure from this time, because otherwise, who's going to write detailed information about poor man's cottage in early 1800s North England? They used all of the original materials that they would have used in constructing the original cottage. They were actually able to use some of the existing foundation of the cottage. They were able to unearth part of the existing walls and build off of that, and like the thatching process and how they reconstructed the beams and the main frame of the house. It was pretty fascinating to watch the video on their website on how they did that. That's the sad story of Joe the Quilter, unfortunately.
Thank you so much for that. Yeah, Beamish is a really great museum. I know we would say that, but they do so much awesome stuff because, you know, it basically does mean either taking stuff and rebuilding it brick by brick from where it was originally, or it just means recreating what would have looked like using original materials from the day. It's an incredible place. We've got some friends who became parents during lockdown, because we don't go to Beamish anymore. We used to go so much all the time. And they were like, we've got a one-year-old now because it's been that long. Because what you do is, if they're any young age, you go on the trams or the historic buses, and they just go around in a loop the entire site all day. And they're happy for hours, and you get to sit down. It's generally the most fun you can have, high-fiving down to Lindsay again. You know what it's like.
I do.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, they're never too young for Beamish. They just sit on a bus for an hour and they gawp and you sit. It's glorious.
Yep.
But my favorite thing about Beamish is, and I shouldn't be saying this because it's probably a big secret, is that they have to have people on site at all times to look after the animals. So in some of the historic buildings, there are people who live there. Because it's like the car park is so far away from where they live, they're allowed to have delivery vehicles for their shopping come on site. So what you do get in Beamish, if you're there after hours, which I've never been, you do get to see the site of a village in northeast England, exactly how it would have looked in the 1850s, except a supermarket van will sometimes drive down the cobbles to deliver food to the people.
The Amazon Prime.
So that's really fantastic of you. Thank you for bringing that story to us, which I did not know at all, despite the huge local connections we have, which you don't.
This is true.
Finish every show with Rabbit Hole Corner, which is the places we end up on the internet that have nothing to do with this show that we just happened across while researching it. And I did look a bit today because I was also interested in how George the Fourth came to become involved in the story of Joe the Quilter. And as we've previously sung, all I know about him from the Horrible History song is "All You Know About Me Is I Was Fat." He actually had a 50-inch waist. That's what we do know about him. So it's not even not even like a bit harsh. Like he was a sizable chap. And the Prime Minister of the time, after Robert Peel, the Duke of Wellington, visited him in April 30 and reported that the King had for breakfast a pigeon and beefsteak pie, 3 parts bottle of Moselle, a glass of dry champagne, 2 glasses of port, a glass of brandy, and a large dose of laudanum.
Gareth.
Yeah, I was like, the Gareth has wild diet. As it's
and so what of it?
Damn it, you by punchlines, Claire.
I'm so sorry.
The problem with our podcast is that Claire, John, and I are frequently so in tune that we do stand on each other's punchlines so much.
Laudanum sets you up for the day, though, isn't it? It's like flaxseed, but slightly more relaxing.
It's only 10 inches off the average American waistline.
You're not wrong.
We're not going to contest that at all.
No.
Especially in the Midwest. Back.
I checked it. It's 38.9 inches is the average American waistline. So, you know, he was getting there. I'm not suggesting there's not a huge difference, but there's 10 inches.
Sometimes that makes all the difference. Hey!
Hey!
I was waiting for someone. I thought I was going to
be well done.
Oh, Claire's got a rabbit hole.
I do. So mine is based around...
In case Madison slips into a coma.
No, I know. You've got to be careful. So mine is based around my jumper, which, if you can read it, it might be by the front. But it's the property of Winnebago Mental Health Institute. I don't know how the fuck I ended up with it, but I have this jumper.
You were an inmate.
Well, that's what we're wondering. So I wore it probably quite offensively at work today, and people were like, what the fuck is your jumper about? So we went down a rabbit hole and Googled it. And apparently it really was a state mental asylum in Wisconsin. We didn't know where Winnebago was. You guys might actually know where it exists. And apparently it housed John Flamang Schrank, who was the attempted assassin of Teddy Roosevelt. There we go. And he was committed there in November of 1912 and then later died in a hospital for the criminally insane in Waupun, Wisconsin. Waupun? Waupun?
Spell it.
W-A-U-P-U-N.
Waupun.
Waupun.
What she said. But yeah. And in 1932, it had 864 patients, 164 staff members, which to me seems a really bad ratio for mental institution.
If they're shanked to the table, which they probably were in those days, it's quite manageable.
Yeah. Pretty common, yeah.
Yeah. It officially had a capacity of 727, so they were well over what they actually should have had as a quota. And scandal erupted, apparently, because a patient died there in January of 1934, and then there were 30 staff sacked, and it all just basically kicked off from that point. And then wow. they did a complete redevelopment of it. And as of 2012, it still exists and it has a capacity now of 169 patients, but generally the daily population is about 171. And they just class the staffing capacity as staffed capacity. They don't tell you how many staff work there now. And I think that's because of the shitstorm that happened when they had too many patients and not enough staff. So I have a jumper from there. I don't know if it was worn by patients or staff.
That's interesting. I feel like normally in our system, if one person died, that was a success. A lot of people died at those facilities. Women would get thrown in for PMS. Mm-hmm. They'd get thrown in for postpartum.
Yes.
If somebody just wanted to get a divorce, it was like
they were like, oh, she's insane. And then they would
throw them
in there. It's scary. That's one of the things that like I think I've become more aware of since Trump became part of the American political culture, is that actually we always think, like, we see America as this very forward power, but actually it's just two different polarizations within the same country. And it's really hard for everyone to come together and actually allow it to move forward because there's such extremes in one nation. It's really weird.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the Civil War never ended.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just shifted.
On paper it ended, but it didn't really.
Yeah.
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 Very obvious that there are still a lot of racial issues that need to be worked through in the US.
It's super obvious where we live too. And also where I am currently residing, COVID does not exist anymore.
Really? So, you must be the only place in the world where that's
congratulations to us. Nobody wears masks. Everybody goes to restaurants and bars. The governor kept trying to reinforce the masks and the legislative powers just kept knocking it down.
Wisconsin, so, everybody.
Super fun. Cheese curds. Hopefully you'll die of a heart attack and not COVID.
Go back to the start, of course, in DeSantis in Florida, as our Floridian representative, was, of course, the opposite as governor, which is like, spring break's happening, mate. We're shutting down nothing, no matter what the cost.
Yep.
So that's a lot of fun.
Right,
super fun.
I was about to say, though, just as it's one of my favorites of trivia, Teddy Roosevelt assassination, is that the one where he got shot in the chest and then it's like, well, I've got a speech to do, so that'll have to come before I go to hospital? Because
he just kept talking. Yep.
Just kept Teddy going Roosevelt. Despite being shot in the chest. Badass president trying to come back to be president again, having stopped.
Yeah, I think that was when he was running again for re-election. Mm-hmm. Regardless of his politics, he was one of the most badass presidents we've ever had. It's because of him that we have national parks. Like, that's a big thing. Mm-hmm. I still, to this day, love his philosophy of speak softly and carry a big stick like that.
Yeah, he's my partner's favorite president.
Like many, many men who share my interests, I am a proper LBJ fanboy in a way that is unbecoming, but certainly I think Teddy Roosevelt comes in a little way behind LBJ. Also, he was so into animals, it became a thing, is my favorite thing about him. So the White House was absolutely wild in his day, because he had about six children with his second wife, who were just running around. Very, very much a just go wild, kids, express yourself. You're only young once kind of dad. Yep. The White House in those days was full of children running around, and also like bears and snakes and shit. Because everyone was like, I hear you like animals. I thought you were a giraffe.
Yep. It was basically like they had their own like menagerie of animals at the White House. And actually, I think of all of the presidential children, his oldest, Alice, is one of the most fascinating characters I've ever heard about. And I'm sad that I can never talk about her on our show. But she, if you have a chance to learn more about Alice Roosevelt.
That's what we'll do then. We'll come on your
please
show.
Please do, because she's fascinating. She is an amazing woman, and she's actually done a lot of really cool stuff. So if you have a chance to learn more about her, please do.
Once again, going full circle back to history classes. Literally, John, the only thing I can remember about Lyndon B. Johnson was the chant, hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today with regard to that war that he'd done? I can't remember. It was Vietnam, Korea, one of the two.
Was it not the Gulf War?
He was trying to stop it.
it was the Gulf War, Claire. Yeah. In 1991.
My microphone stand is slightly dodgy, so in fact, to hold it up, I've actually got, literally, this is what's my mic stand on right now. That's volume four.
John, all I'm saying is, that's not what our liberal schools taught us. Much like Tony B. Liar and George Bush, He was an evil warmonger.
Mm-hmm. All he knew about LBJ was he had an enormous penis.
Ooh, did he?
Mm-hmm. Oh, Claire's interested now.
So did Frank Sinatra, apparently.
Really? How many wars did he start?
He actually had a divorce because his penis was too big for his, one of his wives. She was like, nope.
Surely you know that before, well, like different era, yeah. They don't try before they buy back then, did they?
I think he tried and they all tried quite a lot before they bought anything. Hey, mm-hmm. LB John, can you tell us why your cock's so long? Does that work?
That's what you bring to this.
Yeah. There you go.
We could do many shows in LBJ. I'll have to read.
Especially with that one book of research you've got, John.
Yeah.
This is
but he only has volume four. He needs the first three.
Volume four. So for those of you who aren't aware of this, and this probably make the cut, there's a legendary political biographer called Robert Caro, who is the definitive LBJ writer. So he's literally written many, many books about him. So there's four so far. But what this is now, he is political geekery's George R.R. Martin, because we've had up to volume four, and so far Kennedy assassination has happened and he's been in power for 100 days. Robert Caro is getting quite old, and so everyone is literally like, he really has to get a move on, because I mean, we haven't even had the 64 election yet and he's gonna die, and we're not gonna know how it ends.
You'll never know. No.
He is such a cinematic character, LBJ, and he literally has an arc. There is such a narrative, fictional thrust to his life story, and it reads like fiction. So, and Caro writes beautifully, so it feels like fiction, but he's also absurdly well-researched, and so much so. What happened was, obviously, he's now researching Vietnam, so he's like, I can't possibly do it if I don't go to Vietnam for a couple of years and really get a feel for the place and do loads of research. So him and his wife went to live in Vietnam. He's in his 80s, right? Like, just Robert Caro, because he put out another book about how to be a historian writer. And like, Robert Caro was trending on Twitter. We're like, oh, shit.
This does just sound like, oh, LBJ went to a golf course in California. I need to go there for 2 years just to make sure that it's really good. Publisher, can I have an advance, please? It does. Yes. It strikes me as a bit of... in fact, he's just hoping that he does die before he needs to write another book, because quite frankly, they're a bit of a hassle, aren't they?
So LBJ, of course, at the end of life, grew his hair really long. No one knows really why. And his favourite thing to do, he got possession of like an aquatic car, a car that could go in the water. Yeah. So he was... People would come to see him at his ranch in Johnson City. Like, he's a perfect story, right? He was born in a place called Johnson City that was named after his ancestors, but because his dad was such a fuck-up and his great-granddad was such a fuck-up, like, they were really dirt poor, even though they lived in the city they founded. His entire life is, I'm not going to live like this, and neither is anyone else. And that's like, I will do whatever it takes to improve people's lives, despite the fact that I will have to become the most devious and psychotic man to have ever existed. And that's quite an incredible story. Yeah. So near Johnson City, where his ranch was, where he spent his later years. And like, his fun thing to do is like, come and visit my ranch. And then they drive by the river and he go, oh, drive into the river! On his aquatic car. That's it. So he was a lot of fun too as a president. Because I don't have a river, hell was wholesome corner. It's nothing apart from it, apart. It just makes me happy, and it's a nice way to finish tonight. My eldest had a friend at nursery. Kinder
Make death. It sound like he's died.
No, but she, a few years ago now, her family moved to France, and so they didn't see each other anymore because she'd emigrated. But she's come
so back. They might as well be dead because they went to France.
Yeah, so but she's come back now, and she's literally moved into the house which backs onto ours. In itself, really lovely. And so they're like, they play again together, like nothing ever changed, nothing's ever happened. They're old enough now so that we can just go like, oh yeah, you can go, you know, just go and see Ina, it's fine, you know. It's a there's a little snicket cut, I don't know what you would call it in America, to be honest, but there's a little road between our houses which is a footpath, so we're going to see each other. And at the weekend, she brought round a walkie-talkie. We live so close that they can communicate using their walkie-talkies in their bedrooms.
That's cute.
And they are literally talking to each other on their little walkie-talkies from their bedrooms. 9 years old. It is the most wholesome and beautiful thing I have ever
seen. It seems cute now, John, but give it a couple of years and it'll be like Clarissa explains it all and he'll be up with a ladder against her wall like a rat up a drain pipe. Be careful. That's all I'm saying.
Well, the other one, the youngest one, did ask me this week where babies come from. I gave a sensitive and factual answer involving a special cuddle. And, you know, it's a lot like when we grow things in the garden, you know, you have to put the seed into the ground. And after a while, it grows into, you know, vegetables or flowers. And he said, yeah, that sounds easy.
Going to be so traumatized when he actually first has sex, isn't he? He's going to be like, but I have to put my seed in you.
On the one hand, I'm delighted that I don't have to explain this to two Labradors. On the other hand, I am disgusted when one of the Labradors tries to mount his own brother. So, you know, swings and roundabouts, I suppose.
It's very Game of Thrones over at your place then.
Oh, yeah.
Bon is singing Unchained Melody very loudly, yeah. Which dampens a lot of ardor.
I have a not quite similar story, but my oldest is 6 years older than my youngest, and she was in kindergarten when I was pregnant, so I don't know what that equates to over
in kindergarten.
Is it still kindergarten?
Yeah.
Some places, or nursery.
Nursery.
Yeah, preschool for.
Yeah, so we went to the school for conferences, and her teacher was like, you must have very frank discussions with your child at your house. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, well, we asked her if she was having a sister or a brother. And she said, oh, I'm having a sister. And when we asked her how she knew, she said, well, because she has a vagina. She said, thankfully, we asked her that when all the other kids had already left for recess. Otherwise, that could have been a really hard thing to explain to other parents. I was like, yep.
Internationally,
yep.
It's the same.
That was a fun little birds and the bees story.
I don't know how we ended up there, but I'm glad we did. But yes, so Madison, Lindsay, thank you so much for coming and joining us tonight. It's been an absolute joy. Do you want to run through, I don't know, your socials now, if you want to tell people how they can get in touch with your show or check it out for themselves.
Do you know them by heart, Maddie, or do you want me to do it?
I know nothing.
Claire knows.
That's fine.
I know nothing. I know we have an Instagram.
On Twitter, we're Ye Olde Crime Pod. That's old with an E. On Instagram, we're at Ye Olde Crime Podcast. We're also on YouTube at Ye Olde Crime Podcast. We're pretty much, you can find us on any podcast listening platform that you use. We come out with new episodes every Wednesday. And then every other Saturday, we have a special segment called Can You Crack the Cramp Word? Where we'll have guests on to see if they can guess what a couple Victorian slang terms mean. And that's always a fun segment to do with people who know nothing about Victorian slang.
So. Yummy fur? I can't remember what it was now.
What was it?
Kissy fur.
That just sounds like some sort of dirty...
It does. It sounds like some weird bestiality porn, but it's definitely not. I watched it as a small, tiny child.
And equally, it's definitely...
You had some questions for your parents, which came up at parents' evening.
There you go. Yeah, thank you so much for having us on. You're actually our first international show we've done.
And you with us. I don't know how we end tonight, because usually we're like, if you've been affected by...
Say, I mean, no one's alive that would have been affected, yeah?
Details from tonight's show are on Teletext, page 618. You know what the American equivalent of Teletext is.
I don't even know what that is.
In the old days, in Britain, before the internet, telly would end occasionally, which is a mad thing. But when the television wasn't on, there would be like a rudimentary internet would be on the TV. It would just show like news.
Okay.
You also type in like a number on your handset and it will take you to particular sorts of news. So our show ends every night with what they used to sign off on Crime Watch. Details about tonight's show are found on Teletext page 618. And then we have Nick Ross's sign off. The crimes we cover are very rare. Do sleep well. Don't have nightmares.
I love it.
We're out.